Yes, welcome back to the show here on World Football Daily. It was a big weekend in the Premier League, and of course, we have Premier League action tonight as well, with Aston Villa taking on Manchester City. A man who's going to help us look ahead to that game and, of course, look back on the weekend gone is Rory Smith of The Times joining us here on the line now. Rory, how are you doing, mate?
I'm not bad at all. How are you?
Very well indeed. A pleasure to have you back on the show, mate. It's been far too long. And first things first, Liverpool with a stonking win against Wigan. Do you think that this is a sign that Wigan won't be able to pull off the miracle comeback that we've seen them produce in years gone by?
Yeah, it's worrying for Wigan, I think. My personal feeling with Roberto Martinez last summer was that he'd maybe waited a year too long to make the jump to a bigger job with bigger resources. He's had offers, I think, from Aston Villa twice in the last two summers, and Liverpool, of course, last summer as well. He was very much in for that. And I don't think it's impossible that they'll stay up. You do wonder, Wigan have got the lowest, I think, transfer spend of any Premier League team. They've got the lowest attendance. They've got the lowest budget. You know, they've defied reality really by staying up for as long as they have, both with Martinez and before Martinez. You do wonder whether that magic kind of has to rub off at some point, whether gravity has to catch up with them. And I think there's a risk that if it happens this year, it might set Martinez's career back a little bit, and that would be a real shame because he's a tremendous manager.
Before we start looking at the top half of the table and the European spots and etc., let's have a look at this relegation battle, because a huge win for Queen's Park Rangers on the weekend as well really makes it a four-team fight when some people were writing them off and saying that Rangers were dead and buried already.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? Because they've been written off for so long, and even, I've got to admit, I thought kind of mid-February that they'd maybe run out of games, but now they're 4 points off safety, and that's not a ridiculous amount. You know, it's not impossible to think that they'll close that, possibly even relatively quickly. And I think there is a possibility. Sorry, I'm about to watch a dog get run over, so just bear with me a sec. No, it survived. That's good.
Right. There is a
possibility of QPR finding the points that they need. Obviously, the mass is against them, time is against them, they've left it very late and they've given themselves a problem. But 4 points isn't ridiculous. Looking at the others, yeah, Wigan, as we say, there's kind of a possibility that time will catch up with them. Reading, I've got to no disrespect to Reading, but I've always felt that they maybe didn't strengthen enough in the summer. They look like they've got a championship team. And then Villa, who are a huge club and really should be sort of fighting for the top six, seven, but they've got such a young, inexperienced side. They don't have any sort of quality core, and they don't have the experience really to get out of this. So any four of those, and the other, of course, that QPR winning at Southampton did, was to make sure that Southampton know that they're not out of it yet either. So that, to be honest, that battle, I think going towards the end of the season will be the most interesting one. The title's decided. The top four isn't completely settled, but you have to fancy Chelsea and Spurs to see off Arsenal. And that just really leaves a relegation battle.
This relegation battle as well, it adds a bit more spice with all of these teams seem to be playing each other a lot in the final eight games of the season or so, 10 games of the season or so.
Yeah, that's not a bad thing at all. And the other added extra incentive, of course, is that next year is the year that the really sort of humongous TV deal kicks in, which means that teams are more desperate than ever really to stay in the Premier League. And I think that explains why QPR really kind of gambled the house in the January transfer window. And it's also, conversely, why so many managers have been sacked in the Championship this year, like why that league has been even more unstable than normal. Because there's so much money to play for. If you're in the Premier League next year, you get this enormous television windfall, and teams will do anything to access that. And the ones that don't get it may well suffer for quite a long time to come. So, there's a lot to play for. And as you say, in those final few weeks of the season, you can imagine some fairly desperate battles between the teams as they face each other, because it is really tight down there, and it will be tight until the very end.
Because of those financial implications, are you surprised, therefore, or even more surprised, that Villa have done so little to strengthen that squad in January when they really were still in that battle and looked like they were going to be dragged into this for the full rest of the season?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm surprised that they didn't make just one or two signs. You know, you spend... It sounds stupid to say it, but you spend 20 million quid and the amount of money you could make for that investment is enormous. And surely that is, when it comes down to it, just good business. You've got to speculate to accumulate, I suppose. They've got some good players, those young players have got. great careers ahead of them. People like Kieran Clark and Nathan Baker are good players, and Westwood, the midfielder. You know, these are good footballers. That they will be in the Premier League for a long time to come, I'm sure. But all together in their first full season as professional, as sort of senior frontline professionals, it's a lot to ask of them, especially when you've got sides around there, round about them, who are battling so fiercely to stay up. It is a huge risk to take. And they've kind of gone the complete opposite way to QPR. QPR spent money on seasoned veterans. Villa have trusted to youth. And I mean, if they survive this year, then Villa may well, that gamble may be worth it, because they'll have all of that money from the TV rights and they'll be able to reinvest it, and they won't have a vast wage bill. But if it doesn't work, then it could be disastrous for the club.
Do you think then, out of these clubs, you mentioned QPR have gambled the house with what they did in January, bringing in Samba and the likes. Villa have got players that can be in the Premier League again. When you look at Reading, do you see them as the side that are most likely, if they were to go down, could be back up in a year's time after that, because they haven't overblown the budget and they have kind of a championship look about their side?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. That's the positive spin on it. You could say that haven't brought in lots of overpaid Premier League stars who they then have to ship out when and if they get revenue. They haven't kind of blown all of their money trying to stay up, and if they fail, they don't have money there to survive. But what I would say is that I don't know if that model necessarily works. We've had teams before who've come up and made a point of not changing their team too much, because the model is that if you go up, you might come back down, so it's better to be able to keep coming up than it is to go up once and then sort of collapse, like say Charlton did. Mm-hmm. Blackpool came up and famously sort of said they weren't going to spend lots of money, because that meant that, you know, the season after, if they did go down, they could compete to come straight back up. Burnley did the same thing. It doesn't work. It's a massive risk, because relegation, there's kind of other intangible factors that relegation affects, what things like morale and confidence and belief and momentum. And I think the problem is that if you don't invest in that season to try and stay up, you can go into, if not a free fall, then you can stagnate with that side. But you still have the same team in 2 or 3 years' time, roughly, with a few additions. They've not got the momentum behind them and their belief's gone. And I think that's the gamble Reading has taken. I got to say at the start of the season, I looked at Reading and thought that side is not good enough to stay up. I also thought the same about Southampton and Norwich, though, so maybe I'm not entirely accurate with my predictions. But you do look at Reading, you do wonder whether, if on paper they are the most sort of relegatable side that look most likely to be relegated, just as their players lack that little cutting edge of quality.
Well, there isn't a game, of course, in the Premier League this evening involving a relegation battling side, Aston Villa. Of course, they take on Manchester City tonight, who, it doesn't really matter to the title race, does it, Rory, tonight, this game? It's already over. United have it in the bag, surely.
Yeah, you'd have thought so. It would take a fairly spectacular collapse for United not to win it. I think City need to win to maintain second. I think it's important that they not only finish second, but kind of finish second with quite a big gap on third. That isolates them as being United's principal contenders for next season. But no, in terms of the title, I think that's gone completely. United have got 12 points with 2 months left. There's not enough time for them to drop that many points.
Is this perfect in terms for Alex Ferguson now focusing on the Champions League? Of course, they've got the huge game against Real Madrid tomorrow night.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's given him the chance against Norwich at the weekend to rest one or two players. He's going to have a strong side, but you know, to take the players out of the firing line if he needed to. The danger, of course, is that if United do lose to Real Madrid, then their season is not over. They've still got the title to win, and I'm sure that'll be quite a fillip for Manchester United fans, but it means that they don't have anything to rest players for, if you see what I mean. So it's actually quite interesting that if they stay in the Champions League, you can see City kind of closing the gap, not enough to win the title, but enough to make it slightly more respectable for City, because United will naturally take their eye off the ball a little bit more. If United go out to Real Madrid tomorrow night, then they could win the title by 15, 18 points, because they will just relentlessly play their best players in the Premier League. And what we've seen this season is they are far too good for the rest of the Premier League.
In Spain, they're talking about still the possibility of a treble, some saying that Madrid could come back and potentially challenge Barca still. In Germany, they're obviously talking about Bayern Munich and the treble. In England, the word treble has been mentioned, but almost sparingly at the moment. If United get past Madrid, is that when the floodgates open and people will start talking about Fergie repeating that dramatic treble again?
Yeah, I think so. I'm personally always slightly wary of talking about trebles until the team in question is in the semi-finals of the two cup competitions and quite clear in the lead. Now, obviously, United are clear in the lead. They've got a winnable quarter-final in the FA Cup against Chelsea at Old Trafford, but it's not a gimme by any stretch of the imagination. And I think there's a big question mark over whether they get through against Real. So, yeah, I think it's good in a way that people have shied away a little bit from talking about the treble, because it always seems very presumptuous almost. I remember David Beckham, in possibly his last season at Manchester United, he would have been asked to go through the season unbeaten. And he said, yeah, of course we do, that's the aim. And I'm sure that's the aim for every team, from Manchester United to Doncaster, to go through the season unbeaten. Footballers never go into matches thinking, oh, it's all right if we lose this one. They want to win every game. But saying it, the headlines that produced that interview, it was Beckham, we can go unbeaten. And that was 12, 15 games into the season. And it looked incredibly arrogant. And sure enough, within a couple of weeks, United lost the game. So I think, we are only at the start of March. They still haven't beaten Real Madrid. They haven't beaten Chelsea. Once they're in the semi-finals of the FA Cup, once they're in the quarter-finals of the Champions League, then maybe you can start talking about it. But it's too soon at the moment, even for Barcelona, for Real Madrid, and even for Bayern Munich.
We'll be waiting for your headline when it does come out, though, Rory. I'm sure of that. There's there's plenty of battling just below the Manchester clubs. Obviously the London trio of Tottenham, Chelsea, Arsenal, all fighting it out for those Champions League spots, and Tottenham really denting Arsenal's chances of getting back in the Champions League next season with that 2-1 win. Terrible defending at the back once again for Arsenal. Wenger has to sort something out with these centre backs because it's just not working still.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. There's this idea, and it happens every year with Arsenal when their season ends in February, that if they can spend £50 million, £70 million in the transfer window, that it'll solve all of their problems. But there's a much more fundamental problem than that, which is that they are not a cohesive unit at the back. They don't look sort of solid and impermeable and difficult to beat. If I was playing Arsenal, I'd always fancy my chances of scoring, because they will give you an opportunity. And I think that's a severe problem. And that's something that Wenger has to sort out himself. There's been all this talk about whether Wenger's lost his way, whether he can turn the club around, whether he's key sort of loyal to his principles. And those are all perfectly legitimate questions. But the bigger issue is whether he is coaching his players sufficiently well to get the best out of them. And I think what we saw on Sunday afternoon with Spurs scored the same goal twice, basically, that there is a problem in terms of the defensive organisation. And it's up to the manager to sort that out. And if he can't sort that out, that's where you have to start asking questions as to whether he is capable of doing the job for which he is employed, which is to get the best out of his players, to organise them into a team that's difficult to beat. And that's kind of a fundamental issue at Arsenal, I think, that's kind of ignored amongst all the talk of, transfer war chest and not spending money and self-sufficiency. The basic meat and drink of being a manager is getting the best out of your players, and Wenger isn't necessarily doing that at the moment.
Everybody's been talking about Steve Bould and his impact on this Arsenal side as the assistant, and a lot of people expected that to shore up the back four. Is there a finger of blame at all to point towards him, or is Wenger taking all the slack on his own shoulders at the moment?
It's quite interesting. When Arsenal started the season, they were defending very well. Bould was getting all of the credit. And now that they're not defending well at all, it's quite strange that he's not getting all of the blame. I suppose he should take some of the blame because he is. You presume he has a special sort of defensive expertise that Wenger will be using. But yeah, it's something that Wenger has to kind of take criticism for as the manager of a coaching staff. So he's ultimately responsible, so he takes all the criticism. But I think what this has shown in the last few weeks, that all that praise for Steve Bould, who was a great defender, assuming that he would be a great defensive coach, is not necessarily true. And he shouldn't get all of the blame now, nor should he have had all of the praise at the start of the season.
I mean, you look at the players that they've brought in, such as Vermaelen and Koscielny at the back, and then you compare it to Tottenham on the weekend, and the man of the match was Jan Vertonghen, and you look at the class that some other teams have been able to find with just spending maybe that little extra bit of money, and Vertonghen almost exemplifies that. He's been fantastic in his first season in the Premier League, has he not?
Yeah, he's been superb. And I think anyone who saw him at Ajax wouldn't have been desperately surprised. He, like the Minor when he first came, you know, he was Ajax's, probably Ajax's best player. Certainly after Luis Suarez left, he's a top-class international centre-back. He can play left-back, he can play in defensive midfield. He's an excellent technical footballer. Yeah, he's done superbly well. What I would say is that it's not a matter of finding value. It's not like Jan Vertonghen was hiding somewhere in a forest. He was captain of Ajax. That's not hiding. That every manager in the Premier League should have been aware of Jan Vertonghen. He wasn't desperately expensive, and it's credit to Spurs that they went and did the deal. That obviously you can't blame them for that. But why other managers, other teams who might have been able to get Vertonghen ahead of Spurs, people like Manchester United, maybe don't need a centre defender, but Manchester City or Arsenal themselves, why they weren't in for Vertonghen and why they couldn't get the deal done is a different issue, I suppose. It's something that needs to be looked at both those clubs. There's loads of players like that. Yolan Kabay is a great example, who's hailed here as being this example of great scouting. But Yohan Kabay was captain of the French champions and a full French international. That's not scouting. Every manager in any top-flight club in the world should have known about Yohan Kabay. And if they'd seen him play, they'd have seen an excellent footballer who had a £5.5 million release clause. So they should have been in for him, but they weren't. And I think this is where we get into an issue of how clubs do their scouting, effective their scouts are. And again, in terms of Arsenal, for both people like Vertonghen and Kabay, you have to ask questions. Why aren't they looking at these players?
When we look at this Tottenham side and see how far they've come at the moment, a lot of people pointing the finger saying this is a one-man side with Gareth Bale. But did you think that result against Arsenal showed that this is a team rather than just a one-man team with just Gareth Bale providing everything for them?
It's difficult because Bale is a world-class footballer and he is Tottenham's best player by quite a long way. And to an extent, I suppose, they are a one-man team. I saw them against West Ham last Monday night. And they would not have won that game if Gareth Bale hadn't been playing, no question. They would have been beaten. They had a fair few chances first, but they were largely outplayed. And West Ham, I think, if there hadn't been the threat of Bale, would have been a lot more confident. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. What Spurs have is a lot of very good players around Bale who can sort of work for him almost and allow him to produce his best. And then they have Gareth Bale, who is probably the best, let's not be controversial and say one of the best 10 footballers in the world at the moment. And I think that's always taken as a criticism, but it shouldn't be. What Spurs have done is they've built a platform to allow Bale to show his talent, and that's their job. They've got a uniquely gifted footballer who they are allowing to perform, and there's no shame in that at all. So one-man team maybe shouldn't be used quite as pejoratively as it should, I think. But he is, there's no denying it, he is head and shoulders above certainly the rest of the Spurs team and most of the Premier League, with two or three exceptions.
And there's plenty to be fighting for in a Tottenham shirt this season. Automatic qualification into the Champions League is obviously up for grabs, and possibly second place as well. Rory, it's a pleasure to have you on the show, mate. Sorry for taking up so much of your time. We'll let you get back to writing that treble title headline for Manchester United, and we'll hopefully get you on the show as soon as we can, mate.
Thanks very much, mate. Take care.
Take care. You too, man. Rory Smith joining us here from The Times on World Football Daily, talking all things Premier League action. And of course, it was a big weekend in terms of the Champions League spots, with Arsenal losing at White Hart Lane to Tottenham Hotspur. And they now sit 5 points off Chelsea in fifth place. Chelsea up into fourth, with Tottenham now in third place, just 2 points behind Manchester City, who play tonight against Aston Villa. We're going to take a very quick break here on the show. When we return, we're going to be wrapping up the rest of Monday's action, and of course having a little listen to what Rafa got up to down at the HDC this weekend. We'll be back in just a sec.